Recordings have begun.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the IRTP Part D Working Group call on the 28th of April, 2014. On the call today, we have James Bladel, Volker Gremmen, Holly Raitt, Barry Cobb, Barbara Knight, Kristen Dorian, and Angie Graves. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Chris Chaplow. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Amy Bivens, Barry Cobb, Steve Chan, and myself, Terry Agnew. I'd like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, James.
Thank you, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IRTPD PDP Working Group call for, what day is this, April 28th. And as per our usual procedure, if you could please indicate whether you have any updates to your statement of interest. If so, please raise your hand in the Adobe room or get my attention if you're not in Adobe. Okay, seeing none, I would then ask folks to take a look at the draft agenda that was posted on the right-hand side of the Adobe room and also was circulated by Lars earlier. Anyone have any comments or updates to that agenda? It's fairly straightforward. Lars, go ahead.
Thanks, James. It's Lars. Just a quick note. As London, the next ICA meeting is coming up sooner than later. I just wanted to raise the point that if, in case the group is not has not finished the final report in time, whether we want to schedule a face-to-face meeting, which we can always cancel later, but whether we should do this now. The internal request has come around already to be in touch with Glenn and book a slot. So I would suggest that I go ahead and do that, and if we manage to finish in time, we can always cancel it beforehand, which is much easier than trying to schedule a last-minute meeting.
Okay, so your recommendation is that we grab that meeting slot now while the London meeting is being planned, and then that way, if we don't need it later, we can just drop it.
Yes, that's correct.
I see numerous green check marks. I agree, and I see numerous green check marks in Adobe, and Volker would like to comment. Go ahead.
Yes, one question coming up from the organizing team for the GNSO Council with regard to the Saturday-Sunday sessions is whether we would like to have a presentation slot as well for the IRTPD. We are trying to streamline the working groups that are presenting at length during the council session to leave more room for discussions when there's nothing to present that's actually currently new. So if we are not presenting a final report, it might be a consideration to have a very short slot or ask for just no slot at all, depending on where we are.
Thank you, Volker. I think that's a good point, particularly given that if we do not have a final report ready, we probably just need more along the lines of a status update without a formal presentation with slides and things like that. So I would recommend we take the same approach, which is to ask for a brief slot on the weekend agenda, let's say, you know, the 15 to 30 minutes, whatever the typical allocation is, for a PDP update, and then if we do not need it, then we will notify you as quickly as possible, and that's my proposal. Lars?
Yeah, just to add that very quickly, on the weekend session, there's usually also the agenda point of discussing motions, forthcoming motions, and so if we do finish as planned at the moment, there should actually be the motion being tabled to adopt the final report by the GNSO Council. So there would also be discussion under that agenda point as well. Just a side note for Volker when he puts through the request.
That's a good point, Lars and Volker. If you could indicate that on the request, I would hope that if we are ready with the final report in advance of the London deadline, that we would also tee up the necessary motion for the council, but yes, it would be good if they are if they're seeing it for the first time. So, does that work, Volker?
Yeah, it sounds good. Just give me a an approximate deadline when I can expect that information so I can slot that in?
I think we should have a good idea in the next couple of weeks here. Perhaps, you know, like the general session, you should secure us a 30-minute slot now, and then we will let you know as soon as possible if we don't need it.
All right.
Because I think ambitiously we want to use that slot because we want to be done. So, okay. Thanks, everyone. Let's then move on to, let's consider this draft agenda adopted, and then let's move to item number two, which is a review of the public comments. We did receive two comments. One, I believe, from a I actually thought we had more, but maybe I'm misreading here. But I thought we had one from the. Yeah, we do have more. Never mind. Forget my earlier statement there about two comments. We received several comments. I know that the registrars, I had asked around, and I think that registrars were comfortable not only with individual comments, but also those representatives who are currently participating in this working group. So I think that for those wondering why you know, we were conspicuously absent, that's probably the background there. Lars has prepared this comment review tool, which for many of you who have participated in other PVPs should look fairly familiar. And the objective or the approach is to read through each comment as, you know, objectively and on its own and ensure that it is either addressed in our existing draft report and draft recommendations and develop a response, or if it is, in fact, novel information and something that we hadn't considered in our previous work, then we should discuss how we want to address this point raised in the comment and whether or not we need to modify our existing recommendations in our report and then what the response on that would be. So so with that in mind, I think that we can begin, if there are no objections, we can begin reviewing these comments that we received and make the determination of whether or not they are compatible with our existing report. So, Lars, if you don't mind, could I, because I'm starting to lose my voice here a little bit, I'm not sure why, I'm wondering if I can press you into service to read through the recommendation and then the comments as well, and then we'll manage a queue on each one.
Sure, this is Lars. No problem, James. I've released the document. I'm just going to think it back very quickly so we're all on the same page. Recommendation one, the working group recommends that reporting requirements be incorporated into the TDRP policy. Outcomes of all rulings by dispute resolution providers should be published on providers' website, except in exceptional cases. The group recommends publishing reports that follow the example of the Asian Domain Dispute Resolution Center, the ADNRC. These reports should include, at minimum, information about parties involved in the dispute and the full decision of the case and the date of the implementation of the decision. This has received two comments, one from Arthur Sonnenberg. In general, this is a good idea that you support. This will give precedent we can all refer to and make the rules more clear to everybody. So supportive of the recommendation, and the business community considers that reporting requirements for registries and dispute providers should be developed in order to make precedent and trend information available to the community and allow reference to past cases and dispute submissions. The BC supports the details of our position on Charter Question A that are encompassed into the recommendation number one. So also generally supported.
Okay, thank you, Lars. So we have two comments on this recommendation relative to Charter Question A, and both are supportive of the working group's recommendations. I could open the queue if anyone wants to weigh in on these topics, but in general, I would say that the response is simply to acknowledge that that these comments were received and supported, and that recommended action is to proceed with the recommendation as drafted. Thoughts, comments? A green check mark from Barbara. Thank you, Barbara. Okay, it looks like we are generally supportive of that approach. So, Lars, if you could make that note, we can move on then to recommendation two.
Sure thing. Recommendation two, the working group recommends that the TDRP be amended to include language along the lines of this revised version of the UDRP. As a quote, the relevant dispute resolution provider shall report any decision made with respect to a transfer dispute initiated under the TDRP. All decisions under this policy will be published in full over the Internet, except when a dispute resolution panel determines in an exceptional case to redact portions of its decision. In any event, the portion of any decision determining a complaint to have been brought in bad faith shall be published. There's only one comment from the business community. As you can see, I just scrolled down. The BC supports the details of our position on Charter Question A that encompass into recommendation number two. I'm sorry, I copy and pasted that. I didn't edit the comments. I should have a little stick behind it. There we go. Also, same as before, a supportive comment, and nobody else said anything on this.
Okay, thank you, Lars. I think that this is also fairly non-controversial. I think the only potential detail that would have to be ironed out in implementation would be any rules established on what determines an exceptional case that allows a report to redact portions of its decisions. I don't know that there were any comments on that, so I think we can move on, but I think that perhaps that's something that we can note. The implementation of the policy might include some guidelines on that. Christine?
Hi, thanks. This is Christine from National Arbitration Forum for the record. I just wanted to make it remind the group that I know when we talked about this originally, the language as stated in Recommendation 2 is right out of the UDRP, and the UDRP does not have an itemized list of what those exceptional circumstances are. It leaves it up to the dispute provider, or the panel, or whoever is making the decision to find exceptional circumstances. And indeed, the circumstances are very exceptional. It's not something that anybody is currently abusing. So I just thought I'd throw it out there that we may not actually need to do anything here, because where the thing we're taking this from, the model, is actually not, doesn't have an itemized list.
Okay, thanks, Christine. I do remember that discussion, and my suggestion wasn't necessarily that we modify or provide for a list like that necessarily, just, you know, perhaps even provide some helpful examples. And if they're published somewhere in the rules, for supplemental rules, for example, for the UDRP, I'm wondering if that is something that can be shared, or is it just overkill at this point? You know, what are the thoughts of the group?
Well, this is Christine from NAF. It's not published in anybody's supplemental rules. I can tell you that the way our panelists have found, the only time in which they redact any portion of the decision is when that they find that there's identity theft. So when somebody is accused of cyber squatting and hijacking a domain name and you know, maybe counterfeiting or something, and they come forward and say, wait, my credit card was stolen, I had no idea this domain name was registered. In 50% of those cases, the complainant agrees that there probably was identity theft and asks the panel to redact personally identifiable information like the party's name or location. And then the other 50%, the complainant doesn't necessarily agree, but the complainant doesn't really fight it either and says, hey, if the panel thinks that this was really identity theft, all we care about is that we get the domain name, so you want to redact the respondent's identity, do it. So those are the only situations in which any panel, to my recollection, has ever ordered redaction of a decision.
Okay, thank you. I think that's helpful. Lars?
Thanks, James. This is Lars, for the record. I meant to say that we've also circulated these recommendations internally and received a few comments back from the Registry and Registrar Services. Understand a couple of, or there was a few clarifications that went back and forth, and so the document isn't entirely ready yet. We'll send this out during the week, but there's a couple of points on the various recommendations, depending on how we go, that I'd just like to enter into the record right now, so the group doesn't have to go back on them, if that is okay. And there's an issue here that the services, that the registrar services mentioned, which is that whether we want to consider that private individuals, the registrants who are part of these cases, should be given the option, either an opt-in or opt-out, to have their personal details withheld from the publication of these proceedings.
Okay, and that's appearing in I'm sorry, that's you're taking that from a comment?
Yeah, I'm taking that one comment. I've got the comments from the registrar service, but the document that they sent back, they need to refine a couple of points that I didn't want to send out as it was to the group. So I'm just already transmitting the comments that they've made.
Okay. Well, I think that's aligned somewhat with what Christine had mentioned. So perhaps we should put a marker here on this for recommendation two, that that the comments received were supportive of the recommendation. However, you know, we want to maybe come circle back before we get to a final version of this recommendation and circle back and make sure that we captured those concerns or at least noted them, you know, somewhere, if not in the recommendation itself, and maybe in the body of the report.
Okay, that's good.
Okay. Well then, and Lars, was that a new hand, or you're just going on recommendation three? Okay, well, let's take a look here. Recommendation three. The working group recommends that TDRP be amended as follows. Transfers from a gaming registrar to a third registrar and all other subsequent transfers are null and void if a gaming registrar acquired sponsorship from the registrar of record through an invalid transfer as determined through the dispute resolution process set forth in the transfer disputes resolution policy. And the first comments from the registries. The registry stakeholder group is supportive of this recommendation. It is the opinion of the registries that an invalid transfer should be defined as a transfer that occurs in violation of IRTP. With regard to the question of whether costs would be needed to be refunded to registrars in case of negating or reversing transfers under a multiple hop scenario because of the undo of a transfer case in cases where it has been determined that the transfer occurred in violation of the IRTP changes, only the registrar record and the expiry date of the domain remains the same. It is the view of the registry stakeholder group that there should be no refund of the registration fees cost. Okay, let's spend a little bit of time unpacking this because I think there's a lot of information here in this comment. And just as a reminder to folks, each time domain name transfers, there is a fee charged from the registry to the registrar and then presumably from the registrar to the registrant. That fee is typically equivalent to 1 year's registration fee, and then the result is that a full year is added to the term of the domain name registration. However, if the domain name registration is less than 1 year from being 10 years in the future, then I think it just takes it to the maximum 10 years or 9 years and 364 days or whatever the logic is. I'm sure Barbara's cringing over there, but it's something along those lines. So, but in general, I think the concern here is that if a domain name were to, let's say, go through three hops and the first HOP were determined to be invalid, what happens to the fees that were charged for the subsequent HOPs? But also, I think, you know, in the same vein, what happens to the date of expiry? So that's, I think that is, and then the registries are pointing out that that is a concern, and that their recommendation is that there should be no refund of the registration fees. And although it's not explicitly stated in this excerpt from their comments, I presume that means that any extra time that was added to the registration would also be intact. I don't know if it's if that is added as well, but it seems like if you're not removing the reversing the fees, that we would not necessarily also reverse the transfers. Barbara is going to hopefully shed some light here. And Barbara, I think it would be interesting to note how we handle that today.
So, thank you, James. This is Barbara for the record. So I think the comment does actually state that only the registrar of record changes. The expiry date does not change. So from that perspective, to the extent that there were multiple HOPs and additional years were added to the registration, those years remain. So it's literally only the registrar of record that changes in an undo, if you will.
Okay, thank you. So it's just the first, the fee associated with the invalid transfer and the additional registration time term associated with the invalid transfer. Only those parts of the transaction would be reversed. All subsequent transactions would be treated as legitimate.
If I could just clarify, James, Barbara again. So,
yep.
I mean, everybody looks at it as a regular transfer. Unless we hear otherwise, we would consider it a legitimate transfer. So from a registry operator's perspective, at least VeriSign's implementation of this is that, you know, the fees get charged as the transfers occur. And when the undo is done, it's done through we actually have a tool that does it, where it just it literally changes the registrar of record on it, on the account. So I don't know if there's anything that's done at the registrar's, you know, to take into consideration what the fees are, but our system would not change, you know, reverse any fees in association with undoing a transfer that was considered in violation of the policy. I don't know if that helps to clarify or if it just muddies the waters a little more.
I think it does. Thank you. And it just got me thinking about something else, which is, suppose that the first transfer were determined to be invalid, but also the third transfer were determined to be invalid. I think the way we approached this recommendation was that the third transfer being invalid really didn't matter because the registrar of record would revert back to the state that it was in prior to the first invalid transfer. However, the registrar involved in that third transfer might feel that they have a case to get their fee, to recover their fee as far as a refund. If they can demonstrate that it was, you know, part of the same invalid or fraudulent process. So I think that we need to consider this a little bit more. Go ahead, Barbara. I'm sorry. I was just kind of mulling that over, but go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, James. It's Barbara again for the record. So I guess this kind of speaks to the, you know, one of the issues that we're dealing with further down, and that's the, you know, the statute of limitations. And, you know, right now the statute of limitations is 6 months, so there's, you know, there's a limited number of HOPs that can actually occur. When the registry operators, and I don't know, maybe Christine can speak to it, you know, from her perspective as well as a dispute resolution provider, but, you know, when we're processing a dispute, you know, obviously there's a gaining registrar and a losing registrar typically involved. And so we would look at it based on the grounds of what is actually being filed. So if, for instance, there was a couple of transfers that occurred, the first one, as you were indicating, was done in violation of the policy, and then, you know, maybe there's a, you know, a third one that occurs, and that's also done in violation of the policy, then from a dispute perspective, when we're looking at them, if it's the dispute that was done, you know, the third HOP, then yes, then we would consider that one as the one that's done in violation. If somebody comes to us from, you know, Registrar A to Registrar B, considering that to be the first transfer that was done in violation, We wouldn't really look at the third one being done in violation. We would basically just evaluate the case on the merits of what was being filed for the transfer relative to the transfer from Registrar A to Registrar B. Does that make sense?
I think so. But I think that just further demonstrates why we probably need to spend a little bit more time on this issue that was raised, I think, in, I think it's a good comment from the, and an excellent contribution from the registries, and something that probably needs to be examined a little bit more closely. Even if we just end up reinforcing our original recommendation, we can at least clarify on this particular point. So, Christine, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. Thanks. I just wanted to sort of echo what Barbara said and also maybe just offer a clarifying statement, which is we also do not look back past the original parties. So if the transfer between parties, C and D, if those are the parties that are in front of us, we don't look any farther back to see was there an illegitimate transfer that preceded C and D. Yeah, parties A and B would have had to bring a dispute, or A would have to bring a dispute against F or whoever. But the we also do not look any further back. If the parties, even though the first transfer was illegitimate and the third transfer was illegitimate, if the dispute in front of us was for the third transfer, that's the one that we would adjudicate. There would be sort of no way to go back and figure out, was there some other preceding problem, unless somebody brought it to our attention. So that's, I guess that maybe that clarifies, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
Thanks, Christine. I think that does clarify that scenario, and I think that's helpful. I think the scenario that at least I'm still thinking about is that there's not something further back, but there's something in the middle that is occurring where someone can say, hey, I can demonstrate that my hop was fraudulent too. Can I at least get my money back? So maybe that's just something that we're going to have to take a closer look at, I think. Okay, so an excellent point raised by the registry in their comments, and something that we should, I believe, take a little bit more put under a microscope here. So the BC has posted the next comment on this recommendation. Additional provisions should be included for multiple transfers in the dispute TDRP that set out how to handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred, as they could help clarify the process and facilitate the handling of disputes. Multiple transfers are used in domain hijack situations, and also since the aftermarket has developed after the policy was written, the third party can easily purchase a hijacked domain in good faith. BC supports the details of our position on charter question B that are encompassed into recommendation number 3, 4, 5, and 6. The BC particularly appreciates the work of the working group in developing these complex and carefully composed recommendations. So, let's unpack this one here a little bit. I think that the BC is generally supportive of the recommendation as it stands. Am I missing something here? They want to see some clarifications on what happens when a domain name is purchased in good faith after it's been hijacked. Is that... Do we have a representative from the BC that can maybe... We're missing Chris. Well, I'm trying to see here if there's anything that is going to take us down a different path that we haven't already covered in our recommendation. And I'm asking the group and certainly opening up to Lars if they spot anything here that... is novel, and I think that in most cases it seems to be a reinforcement of the deliberations that were used to arrive at that. I don't know. Christine, I don't know if I'm breaking up. Does anyone else hear audio problems? I'm on my phone, so it's not the Adobe.
It's good here, I have to say, this last.
Okay. Barry notes that it's clear. Graham says it's fine. I think it might just be you, Christine. Okay, thanks. All right. Excellent. So then moving on to comment number 6, which is the third comment on this recommendation. Null and void. Now this is coming from ICANN staff. Null and void is not appropriate terminology. I think it may be reversed at the direction and within the discretion of the dispute resolution panel. Can we scroll back up, Lars, to which specific phrase is being targeted here by staff? Are null and void. Okay. And I'm interested in our new stakeholder, ICANN staff, is helping us here to understand why null and void does not work in this context. Not appropriate terminology, I think. Maybe reversed at the direction of the discretion of the dispute resolution provider. I don't know that that's what we were going for here. I think what we were trying to communicate with this recommendation is that if the first transfer determined to have been invalid or is invalidated through some sort of dispute resolution process, then all subsequent transfers would necessarily also be invalid, and as if they had never happened. So, I guess maybe, Lars, maybe you can help me here. Barbara's first in the queue. So go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara. So maybe we can say that the all other subsequent transfers are subject to reversal. Does that get us where we need to be?
I like the language. I'm not clear on what problem we're trying to solve. We don't like null and void because why? Because go ahead, Holly.
Yeah, I'd really like to understand why null and void is not what we mean, because I think that's what we did mean in the end. So if you say, if we just use the term reversible, it completely changes what we actually arrived at. So I'm trying to understand why that doesn't work. And then do we have to reopen this? Because I think if null and void language is changed, then we actually need to really rediscuss what we sort of have gone through at some point. Thanks.
Thanks, Holly. That is exactly my concern as well. I'm not against changing the language. I just want to understand if, you know, we're changing our intent or what problem we are trying to tiptoe around here. Lars, maybe you can shed some light.
Well, I wish I could. I'd like to point, just Christine mentioned in the chat that registries interpret null and void is different, might interpret it, that it's differently than we might, and I think that's probably where the comment comes from too, that it's a legal concern. I would have to go back and have checked what exactly the problem with this would be, but maybe Christine can also elaborate what she thinks. I'm sorry to not break the help.
Hey, thanks, Lars. Christine, you're welcome to respond.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, thanks. This is Christine from NAV. I just wanted to clarify that I know that when I've worked with ICANN staff on the URS and that sort of thing, one thing that's very particular, both, you know, from the UDRP and URS and other policy standpoint, is that having language that only talks about the effect of something is often ambiguous because different people can interpret how that should happen. So perhaps ICANN's looking for specific instructions as to what they want to have happen. So null and void is not like a registry action. It's not a status that something can be at or activity that someone can take. So perhaps what they're getting at is, you know, the registry shall do such and such at the direction of the panel, or the panel can, you know, find that the, you know, all of the transfers should be reversed, or the panel can find that the transfers are null and void, and therefore the registry shall take action A, B, and C. So that would keep like our null and void language in there, but provide a specific direction. That's my only suspicion, is because a lot of times what we're talking about is, you know, we want to have something happen, but it ends up creating a huge problem for ICANN's compliance staff if it's not specific as to how it should happen, and you leave it way too open-ended. So that's my suspicion. I have no idea if that's really what happened, but just my past interactions with ICANN make me think that that's maybe what they're thinking about.
Okay, thank you, Christine. Yeah, I think that could be, I think, you know, you're probably very close to the actual concern here, is that it doesn't leave any specific direction to the registry on what it should do, and therefore it could be interpreted or implemented differently and inconsistently. I see that Holly notes that that makes sense. I think that we should probably ask Lars to check into this one and make sure that you know, that we are understand the pitfall exactly here, because I want to go back to what Holly was saying. I think what we are attempting to state here is that those subsequent transfers after the invalid transfer never happen. How do we express that without running into the problems that Christine raised and that staff, I think, maybe has identified? And I think until we have a better understanding of those problems, we're not going to be able to confidently answer that question. So Lark has that as a takeaway. That's a good point here. And I think that if there's a different way to say it, or if we can craft the language to work around those vulnerabilities, then I think we should. But I think we need to know what those are. So, okay. So if there's no further discussion on that, we can move down to the next comment, which is actually on a different recommendation. So any other thoughts on the recommendation 3, the multi-hop problem? Okay, seeing none, that was a good discussion. Let's move on to recommendation 4. The working group recommends the domain name be returned to the original registrar of record if it is found through a TDRP procedure that a non-compliant domain name transfer has occurred. The TDRP, as well as guidelines to registrars, registries, and third-party dispute providers, should be modified accordingly. First comment is also from staff. The working group recommends that domain name be returned to the complaining registrar if TDRP procedure finds that an invalid transfer has occurred, regardless of any subsequent legitimate transfers. I think that is restating the recommendation. Is that Lars? Can you help?
Yes, sorry. And the concern was that the phrasing of original record, original register of record, is a little bit clumsy, and so this is addressing that issue essentially.
So it could have by the difference between original registrar versus complaining registrar, meaning that original registrar could have been open to, you know, some registrar 8 years ago.
Correct.
Okay. I think that is a minor change, but perhaps something that we could address with some language modifications to clarify that we are not talking about the registrar. You know, otherwise all domain names that were disputed would go back to Network Solutions, right? I agree that should be clarified. And Holly has pointed out in the chat that this might help us address the question above. I think it tells us specifically what to do, Holly, but I think it still leaves some opening with the idea of what we mean by null and void and what should happen to those other registrations or those other hops. But I think it definitely closes in a little bit on that. Any other thoughts? Barry has suggested registrar filing the complaint in place of, I presume, complaining registrar. Either works for me. I don't know if there's any language in other processes like the UDRP that could be, they probably refer to it as complainant. So perhaps we could even use registrar complainant.
Yeah, this is Christine from NAF. And when Mikey and I were working on the original draft that we decided not to use, we I pointed out that using terminology, and maybe we can't get away from it, like registrar of record, gaining registrar, et cetera, often tends to be very confusing, especially to panelists who are, you know, well-trained legally. But, you know, this idea of who's gaining and who's registrar of record. So, you know, going with, you know, much simpler terms such as complainant and respondent or complaining registrar and responding registrar actually would make things far simpler from the provider's and the panelist standpoint. We may not be able to get there, but, you know, any time where we could do that, that would be fabulous. And I had recommended early on of making those be defined terms in the actual TDRP and or rules.
Okay, thanks, Christine. I think that's helpful. I think the question is, which language or terminology do we align with? Because in the IRTP itself, the terminology is registrar of record for the losing registrar and gaining registrar. So if we want to align the terminology with UDRP, then I guess that changes to complainant and respondent. So and perhaps that is more appropriate for this section, or, you know, I hate to say it, but maybe we need a definitions section to this modification that says something like the registrar complainant is the registrar of record at the time of a at the time that the disputed transfer took place, something along those lines, and then we would establish some definitions that would bridge those two you know, dictionaries from the IRTP to the UDRP. That's just one. There we go, Christine. Everybody loves definitions, right, Christine? It makes life much easier. And I see some green check marks as well.
It's a requirement for law school, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so Lars, is that a? Are we new here? We're gonna charge forth, or oh, there, Lars' hands went down. So can we put there then as a takeaway, Lars, that we want to come up with some definitions of the terminology, particularly I think we want to define registrar of records versus complaining registrar or registrar complainant or however we want to phrase that. We want to define gaining registrar versus responding registrar or registrar respondent. And then we probably should also define the different parties if we're talking about transfer contact, registrant, et cetera. So I think that, I'm trying to follow the chat here with one eyeball on what's going on. I think there's some good conversation, good exchange going on between Barbara and Christine, where Barbara is pointing out that there could also be complaints filed if a registrar is unable to transfer a domain name because it's being blocked by the registrar of record. So the complaining registrar may not be the registrar of record. Good catch, Barbara. That's exactly true. They could be reversed in that regard. So we need to be careful with our definitions. Okay. Let's highlight that as a to-do that needs to be completed before we can consider this work to be final. And I see a green check mark from Lars. So then move on to, oh, we scrolled here. I think we need to go back up to number 8. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So this is from Arthur Zonenberg, I believe, representing a registrar.
Yes, he is. He is. I mean, he said he wrote in a personal capacity, but he's working also for a Dutch, Netherlands-based registrar, I believe.
Thank you. That does ring a bell. So, okay. So comment number 8 to recommendation 4, if multiple transfers have occurred after the first one that is wrong, then only that one should be checked. So far, so good. Checking the entire chain does not seem useful to me. Whether the domain may be afterwards, wherever the domain may be afterwards, it should be rolled back to the state for the first breach, preferably actively by the registry. I think we're all aligned so far. Most of the affected registrants are puppets by a hacker or real users that saw a deal that was too good to be true an inviting price for a high-value domain than it usually is, but it's pretty much a corner case that does not occur often. I think that in summary, this comment supports all aspects of our recommendation. I think that the points made here align with the discussions that we had during our deliberations, as well as that this is often used infrequently, but to some effect by bad people who are trying to obfuscate the source of a hijacked domain name, and that sometimes legitimate purchasers are caught up in this. So I think that that is good. I think that no modification to the language, at least from this comment, is required. Okay. Then moving on, we've got about maybe 13 minutes here. So let's move on to recommendation number 5. The working group recommends the statute of limitations to launch a TDRP be extended from the current 6 months to 12 months from the initial transfer. This is to provide registrants the opportunity to become aware of fraudulent transfers when they would no longer receive their registrar's annual WDRP notification. First comment is from the registry stakeholder group. The registries can support this recommendation, but with reservation. Specifically, the longer the statute of limitations is to file a request for enforcement would also mean that there's a greater opportunity for multiple transfers to occur between when the alleged violation occurred and the request for enforcement is filed. So I think that that is a legitimate observation that the wider this window is opened, the greater the exposure to the multi-transfer problem that we identified in the previous two recommendations. But in general, it looks like the registries support this extension. And I think that we can note this concern, but also note that it's not necessarily derailing the overall recommendation. So moving to number 10, the ALAC particularly supports recommendation 5 that would extend the statute of limitation to launch a transfer dispute resolution policy to be extended from the current 6 months to 15 months from the initial transfer. ALAC is effectively echoing our recommendation back to us with their blessings. So thank you for that. Can you scroll just a little bit there, Lars, or is it going to jump to the next page? Oh, there we go. Thanks. The next question was, comment was submitted by Thomas Rickert, who is, I believe, a NomCom appointee to the GNSO Council, and I believe he raised this at the council workshop in Singapore on the weekend sessions there. Could be wrong on that, but at least that's where I think I remember it was raised. So Thomas notes that since a lot of registrations are paid for 1 year, it would only be after that time the customer might spot that they are no longer the owner of a domain name. This would especially be true in case the domain name is abducted, but the DNS remains unaltered. If the statute of limitation is 1 year and the incident occurred almost at the time of payment renewal, the registrant would most likely lose the opportunity to take action as there would be no or little time left to do so. Example, abduction of domain name on renewal date plus 3 days, limitation would become effective 1 year later, which would leave the registrant almost without a chance to notice that he has not been invoiced and the domain has already gone. Additional 3 months would not really make a difference to the registrars, but they could be very beneficial to the registrant, who in most cases is unsuspecting and will need time to find out the measures he or she can take. So let's take a look at this here, because what Thomas, I think, in general is saying is that we need to extend from 6 months to 15 months to allow for, because most registrants will not notice that a domain name is missing until they fail to be billed for it. I think Mikey was targeting the WDRP reminder. Thomas here is instead targeting renewal. So let's pause here and let's think about that one for a moment. Holly, go ahead.
Yeah, it's exactly the thinking that Thomas has got, that I was discussed at the ALAC meeting, and that's why we actually said 15 months for very much the same reason. It's a matter of when are you going to notice something's wrong, and then how long do you have to do something about it, which is why we say 15 months instead of 12, recognizing maybe we get stuck with 12, but we want to give the opportunity for the victim, really, to do something about it once they're noticed. That was our thinking behind the 15 months. Thanks.
So this is James, if I could just speak as a registrar here for a moment, step outside of the comment tool and just put myself in the queue. I'm a little confused on this one, because if there is an inter-registrar transfer, then the expiry would, the renewal has already occurred. The transfer was the renewal or the billing, and that the there has been another year added to the expiration. I believe what Thomas, and perhaps what the ALAC is also, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Holly, what the ALAC is driving at is more the case where the domain name does not transfer to a new registrar, but instead transfers registrants or changes accounts from one registrant to another. And that's where I start to run into trouble, because as we've, I think, uncovered in our use cases, in those scenarios, it's very difficult to demonstrate that the IRTP was not applied correctly until we implement IRTPC, which includes the provisions for transfers between registrants.
Yeah, okay.
Can we maybe have a larger group discussion on what that, because I don't want to be all alone on that. Would love to hear from other folks, other registrars, other... Barbara?
Thank you, James. This is Barbara for the record. So I agree with what you're saying, James, and also the renewal item also causes me a little bit of concern, because this could go out several years if it was a multi-year registration anyway. So I'm not certain that going from 6 months to 15 months is really going to buy us that much, but that's my opinion.
Thanks, Barbara. And just, you know, personally, I could also see some concerns being raised by the business constituency and other folks that are involved in domain name aftermarket activities, that extending this beyond 1 year means that, let's just say that no purchase would ever be final, at least in some scenarios. So I think that they would be concerned that this would extend that, and I think that we would then also go up to the comments above, where I think it's the registries that note that the longer this window is open, the more likely that we are going to encounter those multi-hop scenarios. Holly, go ahead.
We also did discuss Barbara's point. I think we are not completely wedded to the 15 months, but certainly the 12 months would be something that we would barrack for. We also recognize that there is a problem when you put multi-year, then how long it started to become how long is a piece of string. So I think minimum of 12 months would be the ALAC position. Taking into account what Thomas said, but also listening to Barbara, 12 months would be a minimum, I think. That's why we supported the recommendation, but just added the 3 months, really for Thomas' reasons, recognizing there are real problems with extending it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Holly. I think that that's, I think 12 months is, as the ALAC and as Mikey, when he was involved, and as the recommendation shows, I think 12 months is, we can hang a lot on the 12 months. I think that the extra 3 months, the benefits start to tail off, and the exposure to potential downside starts to increase. So let's make a note here that generally the working group supports 12 months, but believes that 15 months would be would require some exceptional justification. And if necessary, Lars, if you want to put a note here, I could certainly follow up with Thomas. Be glad to speak to the ALAC, although they probably would rather hear from Holly. If we want to circle back to the folks who are raising this particular proposal and ensure that we are fully understanding their concerns, and perhaps see if we can assuage them by discussing that this is either an issue for IRTPC implementation or something that should be addressed, should be addressed elsewhere. We have an opinion from ICANN staff that the justification seems weak since registrants are unlikely to notice and take action because of a missing WDRP notification. Tend to agree, but it's what we have. And I think that, there are the options are limited to actively get the attention of a registrant that is ignoring its registrar communications. But this is just one. I don't know that it is weak, but I think weak is preferable to none, and I think that so we shouldn't remove it. Any other thoughts here? Okay. I do know that we're now 1.5 minutes before the top of the hour, so let's put our pin here, Lars, if you don't mind, and let's make a point to begin discussing. We'll maybe circle back in case some other folks join, want to weigh in on earlier comments, or if you're mowing the grass or something this weekend, that's where I get all my ideas, and then just someone says, hey, wait a second, I want to go back to comment number 4 and talk a little bit more about that or something like that. So we'll circle back here beginning this time next week. Was there, Lars, can you help me? Was there a holiday we were running into this time next week, or that, no, that's, or was it Rob Golding was saying that was that the spring banking holiday in the UK on the 5th?
Yeah, the first Monday in May is a UK bank holiday.
Okay. Rob, are you going to kill us or turn us into the Queen if we continue? Because I think that and the last Monday in May, too. Well, that works because I think that starts to align with Memorial Day, and now we've got multiple countries on that. So let's plan on meeting as per usual next Monday at this time, our typical time slot. And then they're all just working. Yes, life of the glamorous life of an entrepreneur is you don't get those banking holidays off. But let's target that for our next meeting, and we will circle back with this comment. But we will allow some time at the beginning of our agenda to revisit any comments that the folks want to reopen. But otherwise, we'll jump in with number 13. So thanks, everyone, for a good discussion, and let's go forward with where we are. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, James.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. You may disconnect.